So, well, thanks for the introduction. But more so, thanks for inviting me to this workshop, of course. So that was actually much more formal than the introduction. And it's very nice to be back. Of course, I come back every year. But then to talk about this topic, I don't come back. So, okay, great. So Rafael is also here. And so, I mean, you know, so it's wonderful to talk about higher order interference in Waterloo. There is a connection there. So I'm, of course, right now at the Raman Research Institute, which is in Bangalore in India. And I'm an affiliate faculty at the Institute for Quantum Computing, which is where the first three-slit experiment was done, and an adjunct faculty at HRI in Allahabad, which is a primarily theoretical institute and does a lot of quantum theory. So the title of the talk is Non-Zero Experimental Bound on the Third Order Interference Within Quantum Theory. So now, of course, so far we've heard several talks on theory as well as experiment, and the idea was that I3, which we tend to call the Sorkin parameter, but when Rafael introduced it, he didn't call it the Sorkin parameter. But then the Sorkin parameter, or the normalized version of the Sorkin parameter, which we call kappa, is a zero within quantum theory. And then, of course, if we get a non-zero, and which is the quest, of course, to try and get this non-zero kappa in experiments, then we will have something beyond quantum theory. But then, of course, what we have been doing over the last 2 or 3 years since I've moved back to RRI, theoretically and as of now also experimentally, which is, of course, the big joy that the experiment matches theory, is that we have shown that, you know, I3 itself is not going to be zero if we use, don't use all the assumptions that go into I3 being zero. So, of course, what is quite clear is that the Born rule is one assumption which makes I3 zero. So this mod psi square comes in and cancels off. We'll see a little algebra on that and to remind you. And I3 is zero, and then if it's not zero, then we have to think beyond Born rule. And then that, of course, makes us think beyond quantum mechanics. But then there is another assumption in I3 as well, and that is, of course, the superposition principle. And so that is what we have calculated, the correction due to the correct application of the superposition principle to I3. And it gives us very well an experimentally verifiable I3, which is definitely not zero. So now, and then of course we've done the experiment and verified that it's not zero. So that is basically the general idea behind the current talk. Of course, before that, I'll just spend 2-3 minutes in just introducing a little bit of where I come from now, because, of course, many of you already know me from my postdoc days at IQC, but then now, of course, I'm at RRI, and we, of course, spend 90% of our time to trying to measure kappa, but the other 10%, we do lots of other interesting things with photon sources, and which is related to quantum information computing and so on. So then we have a quantum optics lab, which is also a class 10,000 clean room. You know what is a clean room, so it's basically a room which is clean. But then, yeah. So, but what is the, however, the 10,000? So it has 10,000 or less dust particles per cubic foot. That's the definition. Yeah, that's the definition. So I thought someone would say why foot, but that's the definition. But then, and if we are outside a clean room, it's more like 2 orders of magnitude higher. So then that's the cleanliness of the room. And of course, I have 2 labs. The adjacent one will become a class 100, and that would be used for hybrid quantum computing device fabrication and so on, because my background during my PhD days was a lot in nanotechnology and devices. So we'll combine these two. And 100 is better than 10,000 in this case, because it's less dust. And it's a highly modulated environment with precise control on temperature and humidity. And this is something we actually planned for quite some time, because you see, India, I mean, many of you, and of course, Rafael is an adjunct faculty at RRI. So then, you know how it is, but then it's beautiful, but then there can be a lot of dust. So we planned this so that, you know, our experiments are modulated and the lasers work as they should and so on and so forth. So that was the idea. And so, of course, we are one of the first quantum optics lab of its kind in India, which is dedicated to research in these topics. So this is how it looks. So you enter through an air shower or an air curtain, and then all the dust goes off, whatever is there, and you wear some special shoes and so on and so forth. And this is the inside. And of course, there are there's no point in having instruments and no students. So we have some smiling, some not so smiling students. So there are 6 PhD students, and of course we have several other project students who come and go, do their masters, so on and so forth, and several have come and gone. So this is our areas of focus. What do we do? Primarily, our workhorse is photon sources. So we have both. So, you know, yesterday Thomas was describing the heralded and the non-heralded. So then there are different types in which we can use photons. So we can have the heralded version. We can have the entangled version. So we are using them different types for different experiments. So this is a type 1 source. This is the type 2. And these are things you are familiar with. This intersection point represents the entanglement and so on and so forth. So these are all pictures from our lab. And you know, you measure coincidences. That is what you do to prove that if you have one, then it heralds the presence of the other. But then how do you know that you're dealing with one of a pair? So you do the coincidence measurements. So then several applications, studies on entanglement dynamics, studies on weak interactions and measurements. And this is a project with France under a grant from the Templeton Foundation. Then we have studies of spatial correlations in spatial Q-trips. I mean, you know, we have something or the other to do with three dimension. And of course, our experiment is a triple slot that I'll come to. But then we are also using triple slits in the more conventional quantum computing experiments. And this is in collaboration with Thomas Jeniewein, who's at IQC, and Piotr in Poland. And of course, we also have some theory work going on with Barry Sanders, who's at IQST in Canada. And this is kind of coming up with a new approach towards linear optics quantum information. And then, of course, the experiment that I'm going to talk about today is the naive application of the superposition principle in interference experiments. And these are the people who are involved in it. So, okay, so then now going back to the main topic. So we'll talk about a common application of the superposition principle in interference experiments. We will use Feynman path integral formalism to find the Sorkin parameter, kappa. And see that it is verifiably non-zero. So then this is basically a correction term that we propose to the common usage of the superposition using the path integral. We'll show a little bit of the calculation. Of course, the details are there these are the broad papers on which the talk is based. The first one is the theory work. Primarily first and the third one. Second one is there for completeness because that's the first triple slip. And the fourth is the one which we hope to submit in a few days, which is the current experiment. There is an analytic form for kappa and then experimental results. Okay, so this of course forms the basis, and I mean, you know, this audience knows this because we are in the quest for something, trying to find something beyond quantum mechanics. I'm sure you believe that you don't understand it fully and so on. And of course, I'll change that. Nobody completely understands because, you know, if you don't understand anything, that's too bad as a community. So that's the change in the quote, but otherwise it remains okay. So what is it that motivated us towards thinking on this problem? So now we have let us say this is a double slit, okay? So slit A, slit B. We have a source here, and we have a detector here. Now, this is independent of what system I'm dealing with. It could be a source of electromagnetic waves, then we'll solve Maxwell's equations. It could be a source of quantum particles. We could use Schrodinger equation. Then we could, whatever. We could change it. So this theory is independent of that. So it's applicable to photons and electrons. And in fact, that is something we'll show, how the kappa changes for these parameters. So then just for the time being, there's a source and there's a detector. And of course, there's a screen and so on. Now, appealing to the path integral formalism, we know that if we close slit B, and only open slit A, then we'll have paths of this kind. And let us say that the solution to the wave equation, whatever that might be, we call it psi A, because we like psi as a solution. It's not necessarily Schrodinger, it's just a solution. So psi A is the solution to the wave equation when only slit A is open. Now I have closed A, opened B. So then, of course, the solution, I'm going to call it psi B. The question that we have is that when I open both the slits, then is the solution psi A plus psi B? Now, of course, now if you think about it, I mean, I'm asking this question, the answer obviously cannot be yes, because then that's the end of the talk, right? So then it's not. But then it's clear why, because if you have a single slit open, that's a certain boundary condition you have imposed on your problem, on your wave. If you have the B open, that's a second boundary. If you have opened them both, then it's not the same as just opening them individually. It's a third boundary condition that you imposed on the problem. So whether you think about it from the, Hamiltonians, these are three different Hamiltonians, or you think about it, the easier thing to do would be to think about it as a boundary value problem. So these are three different boundary value problems that we are solving, and the superposition principle is only applicable when the boundary condition doesn't change. So if you have two solutions to a certain boundary condition, then the linear combination of that is also a solution. That's the superposition principle. But now that this is a third boundary condition, you just can't naively add them and call that the solution. And of course, however, all these very well-known books on quantum mechanics, as well as Born and Wolf, which is missing here, which is our, you know, Bible for optics, by Max Born and Wolf, you know, the book on optics. There, the same sort of assumptions have been done. So in terms of optics, it will be like amplitude 1 and amplitude 2 adding. And here you are calling it psi. So depending on, it doesn't matter. So it's the same thing which is applied, whether it is in quantum mechanics or classical electromagnetics. And so then, of course, what is done is that you take this and then you mod it, square it, and you get this interference pattern. So that's the common picture that we have used ourselves. Of course, we were not the first people to come up with this thought that this is not correct. So, you know, there is previous work by Yabuki in 1986, where in fact this was the picture that he had used, you know. So you have two slits, S1 and S2. And in fact, now again, going back to the path integral picture, there would be paths like that, which will only come about when you open both slits, right? If you have them open individually, then this won't happen. You have to have them both open for this sort of path to come about. And so Yabuki had actually used this picture to come up with a correction sort of for the double slit case. But the problem, you know, it was great. It kind of is the first one, I think, which thought about this problem. But there was a certain problem with that paper. That was, it was a very ideal theory paper. I mean, that's not a problem necessarily. I mean, I shouldn't say this in Perimeter Institute, but then, of course, the point is that, you know, these slits were Planck length, apparently, in their dimension. And you know, certain assumptions are there in the paper, which are very experimentally unfriendly, let's call it. So it remains a theoretical exercise. And of course, we can't really do anything further from that paper and do an experiment. So that won't happen. And some of the assumptions are also not quite right. But then, yeah, his was the first in this thought process. Then, of course, there was Dirite and his collaborators in 2012, who actually, you know, the triple slit experiment that we had done at IQC in 2010. So he used those parameters and came up with finite difference time domain simulations of Maxwell's equation and came up with a bound on kappa by using that with the same argument that, you know, these are different boundary conditions, so you have to apply them carefully because kappa could be non-zero even from boundary condition considerations. So that was what he had done using classical electromagnetic theory, using Maxwell's equation and FTDT simulations. So the point is, of course, you know, we know why triple slit is important, because we need a clever quantity that can make their contributions the leading term. In case of the double slit, it won't work because the leading term is already IAB, your second order interference, which is already non-zero. So then if you have to have, you can do similar calculations for double slit, which is what Yabuki had done. And that would change this IAB, let's call it A and B are the slits, so IAB to an IAB dashed. But then if you want to do an experiment to differentiate between IAB and IAB dashed, you could spend your a decade trying to get that to be convincing. So you need a quantity which would be zero, and which brings us to I3. So I3, yeah, sorry.
So is it true? It is true that even in the two slit, there are corrections.
Oh, yeah, of course. Okay. Yeah. And we have, of course, either, you know, calculated that and all, as because the two is an obvious calculation which goes into kappa anyway, because kappa is I, you know, sum and difference of double and triple single. So those are going to be calculated. But the problem is that, you know, if you overlap those graphs, you don't make out the difference. So it's a very difficult experimental thing to verify. And we wanted to do something which is also can be done and verified in an experiment. So kappa, I3 or normalized kappa, actually does that. So, and of course you know that. So that is brings us to kappa. So when we first did this experiment, Ray used to be, you know, giving us all sorts of motivational speeches, because it took again 2.5 years to do the first experiment. And this was like, you know, interference is your friend, and all sorts of things he did. So yeah, but then this was just him. Anyway, this is of course someone we know. And of course, was this the picture taken during this paper? I always had this question, but maybe not, right? I mean, I don't know. So this was Rafael, and he wrote this paper. And of course, we know this very well in this audience. And interference describes the deviation from the classical relativity of the probabilities of of mutually exclusive events. If additivity holds, we call that a sum rule. Sum rule says that an indifference term I equal to zero. And so we define this hierarchy. And so this is the thing. So then, you know, PABC, you can just... So, okay, so PABC is the probability when all three slits are open, right? So what has been done is that we have assumed that the psi is psi A plus psi B plus psi C, and then we have done the mod square. So far, we have been worried about this square law, correct? And so basically, we have just done the algebra, and we have come up with IABC, which is the triple slit term minus the sum of the doubles plus the singles. And of course, there is the P0, which will come in the next slide as the necessity for the experiment. So now, in this IABC being zero, we have, of course, assumed bond rule for sure, because that has been the topic of discussion all along for the last 7 or 8 years. But we've also assumed that psi is psi A plus psi B plus psi C. So this is the superposition principle applied just like that. And of course, we have now established that that shouldn't be true. So then there are two assumptions which go into IABC being zero. So when you do an experiment to try and get a non-zero, it need not always be because of violation of bond rule. It could also simply be because you're not doing a boundary value problem correctly. It's actually very simple. So it's a boundary condition. These are different boundary conditions. You do them, add and subtract them. It's not zero. So first you have to see whether that is important to you. And then again, you have to, if that works out, then quantum mechanics unfortunately will be okay. And if that is not true, then you again worry about, because of course the theme of this conference is to go come up with something beyond. But then you have to worry about this. And so I think, of course, you know, this is the slide. I mean, of course, this was what Raphael had said, that, you know, ignoring the possibility that the electron's trajectory winds around in such a manner as to go through both slits. So it's not that he didn't know that such paths would exist. He just chose to ignore them, right? Which is fine, but we kind of thought that we shouldn't ignore them. And then we came up with a model for what happens if you don't ignore them. And then we saw that it's not always going to be small, and you can measure it. So that's the trajectory of our work, which is kind of classical, our work trajectory. So this is kappa. And this now has the P0, which we discussed yesterday as well. And so all experiments reported which measure this quantity implicitly assume that only these classical paths, as we call them, contribute to interference. So what is a classical? OK, so I'm going to say this once more, although we discussed this yesterday, that the classical path are the paths which actually cross the slit plane once. So they just go from source to detector, crossing the slit plane once. And then if there are the paths of the kind which cross it more than once, however that might be, we call them non-classical. Why do we call them non-classical? Because they are not classically dominant. They won't extremize the action. So those are what we call non-classical paths. And so once you know that, then you can digest the non-classical path terminology for the rest of the talk. So the numerical simulations of classical Maxwell's equations have been done by de Wright et al, and kappa was shown to be non-zero. So what is the effect of non-classical paths on kappa? So non-zero contribution to kappa, by taking into account all possible paths in the path integral formalism, would imply that naive application of the superposition principle needs to be corrected in interference experiments, and non-zero kappa does not necessarily imply falsification of bond rule. So that is the main thing, that you first have to worry about these. And of course, I'll come to some questions I have in the end as to what about bond rule. So first, non-zero estimate of kappa is what we had done. And so this was an article that was written on this. So then essentially, these trajectories could actually be detectable. That was the thing. So then you can have straight paths and you can have things which wind around. So this I'll skip. So basically, it involves an integration over all possible paths, as you know. So now I'm going to try and play this. So then just to, yeah. So essentially, you will have the source, you have the detector, you have things, you have paths which are going straight through. And these are the classically dominant ones. These are the ones which will appear. It's not playing anymore. I don't know why. Okay. One second. Okay, so let us see what's going on with the video. So then it's going to have paths which will go straight through individual slits. And then it'll have, it's doing that. Yeah, so then essentially when you have them open one at a time, these are the kind of paths which you will come across. And then when you have them open together, comes the possibility of such things to happen, which wouldn't happen if you don't have them open. all at the same time. So then this is, I mean, of course, just aid to the eye. What we'll come across is that this is not exact. This is crossing the slit plane thrice even. So this is not very dominant. The things which cross the slit plane twice are the dominant contribution, and then it kind of drops. So of course, it's still going to be subdominant. The zero is still going to be the dominant because the classically dominant parts will still dominate. And then when you think about the non-classical parts, we will have parts of this kind, which essentially we will have this sort of a path. So it's hugging path, as we call them in our paper. So it's once, and then it is grazing the second. So it depends. It could do the second, third, or both, or whatever. So these are the kind of parts which dominate towards the non-zero kappa. And then the one that I showed is just easier to draw in a video. And so just to give you an idea. So these are the things which we are trying to talk about. And it'll lead to a modification of the, you know. So it's not just psi A plus psi B. There'll be something else. So we have quantified these. And of course, triple slit provides a simple way to express the failure of the naive application of superposition principle in terms of directly measurable quantities. And it has been used as a test bed, as we know very well in this audience, for several things, you know, some just some representative work, but there is a lot more for experiment and theory. Okay, so then path integrals in the lab. So the green line demonstrates a representative classical path. The purple one is representative non-classical. But bear in mind that this is thrice. So then essentially that is the path which is going to be dominant, which is on the board. Okay, so assumptions. So we use the free particle propagator in our calculations. For a particle in free space and away from the slits, this is a reasonable approximation. We account for the slits by simply removing from the integral all paths which pass through the opaque metal. And we use a steady state description. We assume that the detectors integrate over a duration of time, which is much longer than any other time scale in the problem. Like, for instance, time travel across the apparatus, which justifies the use. Because this is what we do for most photon experiments, because it's very quick, and photon being moving at the speed of light. And so then we also suppose that the wavelength of the incident source is much smaller than any other length scale in the problem. So the sizes and separation of the slits and the distance to the source and detector and so on. And we will present results, I mean, in the theory work. Of course, the experiment, there's nothing, everything is non-ideal. And that's what is the beauty of experiments. But this is in the Fraunhofer regime. So essentially, this is the free particle propagator, as you know. So in this triple slit configuration, entire set of paths from source to detector can be divided into two classes. Paths which cross the slit plane once, KC. Paths which cross the slit plane more than once, pertaining to the probability amplitude, KNC, which is what we call non-classical. So K then becomes a sum of these two. It's not just KC, we'll also have the KNC coming in. So K, of course, is the amplitude of the wave function. So that is the relationship between the propagator and the probability amplitude, which is psi.
So this one on the board goes back through the slit?
No, it doesn't.
Inside the slit?
No, it doesn't. So it's only crossing it once.
It also only crosses once.
Yeah, this of course goes through the slit.
Yep.
And then it kind of grazes the slit plane and goes. So it encounters the slit boundary condition, but it doesn't go back. Because if it went back, it'll have to again go through. So that will be three crossings, which is exponentially suppressed.
But I thought just maybe it would just go through and right back out in the same slit. You're saying it just
It's a straight path. So that essentially, you know, this one is basically a straight path that we have used. So that is the, of course, it's going to again contribute maximum.
Okay. Do you call it non-classical?
Yeah, because it's not, of course, like the greens, which is only crossing it once. So this is twice, and this is the dominant. And of course, we have done several simulations now of using finite difference time domain and so on, which match this very well, which proves that this is indeed the dominant contribution. When we started, we weren't sure.
Get the detector if you cross
detector
the plane.
Detector is kind of here somewhere, right?
Yeah, but if you cross the plane twice, how do you get there?
Why won't it?
Do you mean touch?
Touch, yeah.
So it comes in and it sort of touches.
So it comes in and then hugs the surface. So to speak.
Maybe the word cross is confusing.
Okay. There is an integration
point on that plane.
Sure. So what I'm trying to say is there is an integration involved over this for all the paths which will happen because this has now encountered the slit. Mm-hmm. So then whether you call it cross, a touch is better, I suppose, because cross would mean that it has to come back. So maybe it's not exact. Sorry?
Intersects is
a better word.
Presumably the key is that without the slit, when the slit is open or closed, it makes a difference
exactly
in the amplitude of that
yes.
particular
yes.
path.
Yes, yes, yeah. No, that's precisely the main point.
If the slit were closed, then that particular trajectory would have been absorbed. Is that right?
Yes, because it's a perfect absorber. So that's the boundary. So then, you know, these are going to not allow. Of course, we will see that that won't match with experiments, and we'll have to do some things and so on. But at the moment, it's not experiment. Yeah, OK.
Sorry, another question about this classical versus non-classical.
Yeah.
So you speak that the classical are the action extremizing paths.
Yes.
Of course, there are some action non-extremizing paths that also only intersect that plane once.
For instance, something which does that.
Sure. Is it the case that those just contribute nothing to the amplitude, and so we don't have to classify them, or should I think of them as falling under the non-classical?
No, that's a very good question. So this is not a non-classical path for kappa because of the symmetry. So then the kappa is a very symmetric quantity. So all these paths, so we've shown that in the second work, that these actually cancel off.
Right.
So indeed, we will treat it as a classical path. So that's why the specific definition of the intersection of the slit plane. Because anything which happens before or after, it could do weird things because all that is possible in path integral, but it cancels off from kappa. So only the contributions which are more than once remain. And that has been shown very well in the second piece of work, the theory side. So, okay. So now, of course, I'm interested in talking about the experiment, of course. So this, you should trust me, because it's a very dense slide, right? I mean, too many things are going on. So essentially, we have these sort of paths, which is the classical ones, in which we just go from source to slit and slit to detector. And then, of course, we have these various length scales which come in, which is the distance from source to slit, distance from slit to detector, and so on. So interslit distance, slit width, height, etc. And then, of course, there is the KNC, which would actually involve an integration over this extra path. So that is the KNC. And so then, of course, in the ABC, so ABC has nothing non-classical. It's only going to, because they are just single slits which are open. Only when you have more than one open, this non-classical contribution will come in. And so essentially, OK, so this is how it will look then. So KNC will have this extra integration over the y-axis, which is along that direction. And so then essentially this is the change. So KABC is not just KCA plus KCB plus KCC. There's the KNC ABC, which will involve an integration over both B and C if it goes through A. There'll be different classes of such paths, and all of them have been taken into account, and KAB and similarly. So epsilon, which is the numerator of kappa, was just P. So PABC is then, of course, just mod KABC squared, because, of course, we are assuming Born rule. We can't prove to, there is no reason for me not to assume Born rule to be true. So then mod KBC squared minus KB squared, et cetera, plus. So this is just the same thing that you saw, that we have been seeing so far, but in the propagated language. And kappa is a normalized version of epsilon, as we know, and the normalization actually matters. So in the first work that we had done, we had used, as Thomas pointed out, the sum of IAB plus IBC plus ICA as the normalization. But then when you do this, and when it is non-zero, then that actually leads to spurious peaks in kappa. Because the interference term actually does become zero, right? This double slit interference is zero at certain detector positions. So in those cases, it gives us a false increase in kappa, which is not very physically illuminating. So we decided to choose the, you know, value of KABC mod square at the central maximum of the triple slit interference pattern, which remains a constant throughout any experiment. It's just going to be the central intensity term. So that is what we changed the normalization in this paper, because then that doesn't give us these false peaks, which happened with the previous normalization. And so this was the thing. So then, the red. So this is the interference. So this is the triple slit interference pattern. And this is the maximum. So this is what is used for normalization. And so this simulation has been done using exactly the same parameters as in our first experiment on triple slit. So you have 100 micron slit interslit distance, 30 micron width, source to slit, slit to detector is 18 centimeter, and wavelength is 810 nanometer. And so then this is just an aid to the eye. The red curve is how an interference pattern looks, the, you know, on the screen. And this blue curve is kappa as a function of detector position. So it's obviously not zero. It's modulating. It's a modulating function. It's a very well-behaved modulating function, and it's of the order of around 10 to the minus 5. For these experimental parameters in our first experiment. So of course, that is very good, because of course, it's not zero. That is what we have been trying to say. But it's also not so non-zero that my first experiment is proven wrong. You don't want to do that necessarily. And so there, of course, we had bounded it to 10 to the minus 2, as he showed us also last yesterday. And so then errors were too high that we could have never measured something of the order of 10 to the minus 5. So you have to improve that experiment if you want to measure something, which is 10 to the minus 5. So that was the, that's why the first experiment was just had enough errors that it never could have been sensitive to these corrections. Then of course the
what is IN
is just the, you know, the triple slit interference term. So we call it PAB. So it's just to tell you where, you know, how it is modulating, because this is what you normally measure, right? The interference term, double slit. So then it just to tell you how kappa is behaving as a function, just to help with the visualization. It's not I3. I3 is kappa. So that's the thing, that I3, we call it I3. It's the sum and difference of the double and singles.
Kappa is not the normalized I3?
Normalize I3, of course, I3 and normalize I3. I mean, normalization is important so that you can have some parity between different versions of the experiment. No? But ultimately, it is just I3 only with the normalization.
I'm so confused. What is IN?
IABC is, I mean, so when you, so IAB is easier. So IAB is PAB minus PA minus PB.
Yeah.
So similarly, you have an interference, when you have all three slits open, what will you measure on the detector screen? It is just going to be the normal interference pattern. That's IN. Just to help you, because when you're doing this, so when you're doing this experiment, what do? You measure this one, and then you measure the IAB, IBC, ICA, and then you measure just the singles. So those are just Gaussians, right? Mm-hmm. Sum and difference of that is kappa with a normalization. So this is just...
Is that the definition down there? About
it is kind of there, yeah.
Yeah. Is for an integer, or the n, does it mean something? N?
It doesn't mean anything.
Okay.
Normalized.
Unnormalized.
So, no. There's no higher order. It's just a very simple experimental.
Right.
The usual thing you would measure. So this is the first term, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So KABC squared is what you would with. Of course, everything has to be normalized so that things make sense.
Okay.
But this is just the first term in kappa, right? So this, you know, this. I mean, you know, you will measure that, right? Yeah. So. And so on. And this is just to help you understand. If you're doing the experiment, you'll know what to expect for kappa and so on. Guide to the eye. Okay, and this is the electron. So this was done. This experiment in double slit was done in 2013. So we took the parameters from their experiment. And again, we plotted the same thing. So this is just the interference term. And this is the kappa as a function of detector position. And for these parameters, kappa was of the order of 10 to the minus 8. And in fact, Marcus Arndt, who's in Vienna, is doing an experiment to measure kappa using his molecules. And there he has also measured around, you know, he's at 10 to the minus 2. So he's very much zero at the moment. And his errors come to similar thing. So if you do the correction term, because his parameters are very similar to the electron parameters. So I was there last month and we had lots of discussion. And so it's not precise enough still. So the idea is that we want to come up with an experiment which is precise to the level that we are beyond the error threshold, and we can call that quantity we measure a non-zero. Because ultimately, all these things you measure will be, if it's explained just by the error threshold, then it's all zero. So it's just bound on zero. But we want to show that the non-zero is important. So that's what we have done in the experiment. So we have also done this analytic form. And so I'll not go through the details, but then essentially this one, he showed in his talk yesterday as well. So this is a simple formula for an upper bound on kappa. So if you're not very interested, of course not this audience, but others may not be so interested in all this thing that I've said so far. But then do you want to know whether it will come up in your measurement? Then this is the upper bound using these assumptions, that it's proportional to lambda to the 3/2 by d to the half times w. So lambda is the wavelength, d is the interslit distance, w is the slit width. Of course, these assumptions are important because, you know, this is very crucial. Theta much, much less than kW and theta much, much less than kD. You have to be far field enough for this to hold. If you're too near, then it'll start breaking down. So, but then this is just, again, an upper bound formula which is useful. And in fact, they used it for their 5-path to say that this were around 10 to the minus 7 and so on.
So could you just say it again? So D is the distance between slits?
Yeah,
so
interslit distance, center to center.
And W is the
slit width. And lambda is the wavelength that you're dealing with. So this already gives you a clue how to design an experiment to measure a non-zero kappa. So you have to use lambda, which is high, and you have to use slits, which are closer. So that's what we should try and see how. So this is the formula.
Was that a K or a kappa in that formula?
Which one?
Go back, the one in yellow.
This is kappa max.
It looks like K, that's all.
It's a typo.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's, there's another K there. It's not the same.
This and this are the same. This is not the same, yeah. This is 2 pi by lambda. Yeah. So this is a little bit
itemized. Right.
Yeah, it should have been a symbol, but let's not get into that. It's kappa. It's kappa, yeah. So, okay, and this is also kappa, of course. And so then this is now from the analytic formula. So then, you know, it just tells you, so this red curve is what you already saw, which was from the numerical work. That was the first one. And the blue one is the analytic formula. And so essentially what it tells you is that you see some dots and then you see a line. The dots are the numerical and the line is the analytic. And if you can't make out the difference, that's because it's a very good overlap. So it works very well in the far field, the analytic form and the numerical. So you don't need to worry about numerical integration at all. You can use the analytic, which is what we like, both in theory and experiment. We like a closed form expression for things. And if you're in the far field regime, then you can just forget about numerics if you want to. And this was the electron and same argument about the match and so on. Now, this is the most important one, really, in the theory part of the talk, and that is the remarkable agreement with finite difference time domain simulation. So here you have the black dotted line, which I have taken from Dirac's work, which I have mentioned twice now. These are the formula things, parameters. D is 3 lambda, W is lambda. This is very thin slits, very close, in fact, and so on. And the orange line indicates the analytic expression. Now, the blue line, which leads to the agreement with the FTDT result, is the analytic expression with D equal to 3 lambda, of course, but W equal to 1.15 lambda. And this is what I was referring to 10 minutes ago, that although in path integral we assume that, you know, everything is sharp. I mean, you know, you just hit the thing, then it just dies there. Nothing can penetrate. That's not true in real life. And this was for stainless steel. Dirac had done finite difference time domain simulations for stainless steel. And stainless steel has a very finite complex refractive index. So it has a very proper skin depth that you can calculate. So these parts actually penetrate a little bit into the material as well. And that leads to an effective increase in the slit width, as you can imagine. So the slit width is not just sharp. There's a little bit in, you know, it'll go through. So essentially, if this is the thing, so, you know, there'll be some things which will penetrate here and here and cause this effective increase. So we calculated the effective increase from the skin depth calculation and then using the refractive index. And that's how the path integral matches so well with the FTDT. But the FTDT is a material simulation. There is no approximation. Whereas path integral, as we know, is a theorist's tool. So then how do we make them match? So then you have to use the material somehow. And so that is the calculation we did, and that was the idea. And of course, you know, it took 3.5 days of computation time on a supercomputer for that, for Dirac's graph, and 6.3 terabytes of memory. That's not terribly small. And of course, this happened on that, right? So that's, of course, you know, in PI, we don't need to say this, but there is some beauty in having analytic expressions which kind of give you an answer within a second instead of doing FTDT. Unless, of course, you're doing the experiment where you have to look for those close matches. So that was that, but then, of course, this is also true. No offense, but of course that's the idea, that we want to do experiments, and that's the idea of this workshop, right? So then this was the first one, as we all have seen so many times. This was our bound from various photon number parameters, as we have stood. This was Gregor's first one with Timo, again the three path, and then of course Thomas talked about the five path and so on, and then there was the NMR. So the triple slit experiment that we had performed, We could use that as a perfect tabletop experiment for testing the presence of non-classical paths. But the earlier version had systematic errors, and we were limited to measuring a value up to 10 to the minus 2. So current version, if made devoid, could work. But we could do better things, and I already gave a hint on that 10 minutes ago, when I said that the non-zeroness of kappa is very strongly dependent on certain experimental parameters. And one can definitely find a parameter regime where kappa would be bigger, hence easier to observe. So keeping all other parameters fixed, kappa will increase with an increase in wavelength. You remember lambda to the 3 by 2 by d to the half w. So increase the wavelength, but go crazy about it. Don't just go from 800 nanometer to 1000 nanometer. That's what we can do within the lab, right? Telecom perhaps, 1550. We decided to do an experiment on an open field using microwaves in the centimeter domain. So we are now using 5 centimeter wavelength And of course, that already brings about an increase in kappa from the theory. So then, you know, this is and this is due to thanks to our radio astronomy colleagues who gave us all the know-how about the technical details of doing an experiment of the kind I will show you. So these are the three main people, and I really should acknowledge them, Rengaraj, Surya, and Prithviraj, because they have been working on this now for two and a half years, Rengaraj for the longest time, and they actually spend days without sleeping, because these experiments happen for four and a half days. It's not the easiest thing to do in open field and so on, and they really deserve some special acknowledgement. So this is how it looks. So you have now you have the familiar three again, but this is three slots, okay? It's not three slits. What's a slot and what's a slit? Slot is, of course, actual material. Slit is a hole. So why are we doing a triple slot experiment? Why? Because, I mean, how do you define triple slits? You have some material, and you make three holes, and the rest we know. But this material has to be, in theory, it has to be infinitely long. Because if you have to do integrations, then this part shouldn't come into the picture in your simulation box or whatever. But now think about it. If I want to do an experiment in the centimeter wave, and I have centimeter-sized slits, then to define infinity, I need a kilometer of material, which won't happen in a normal, we don't have that much. It'll have to go from one city to the other to define just that material. So that won't happen. So we reverse the experiment, and we are doing triple slots, because everything is, of course, just open space around it. So then instead of three slits, we have three slots. So then the material is infinite, because it's just open space. So it's a reverse problem. And in fact, we'll show how the formula for kappa changes slightly because of this. But then in principle, it's the same argument will hold that, you have. So again, we can appeal to what is called the Babinet principle also if we want to, which is used very, I'm sure you know about it. The Babinet principle is what we had studied in optics a long time ago, that if you have a screen with apertures and then you define the complementary screen, then the sum of the two actually gives you a one. Yeah.
So should I think of a non-classical path as somehow hitting one of the three and then bouncing to another?
So I mean, essentially the same thing, it'll go through and then the same argument. This is like a four-slit problem. Uh-huh. If you want to think about it in a slit perspective, but that brings about interesting things in the path integral, which I'll just come to. The four-slit is not easy because why? Because you have to define minus infinity to something and plus infinity to something for two slits, and that is not very straightforward in simulation. And this is how it looks. The final version of the experiment actually involves this tent because, of course, it's in an open field and. There is wind and there is rain and such things. So then now we have this bona fide tent, which we have tested for its transmission to microwaves. It's perfectly transparent. So, and this is our slot stand. Now, the things that go into doing this experiment successfully are very different from what we conceive of, even as experimentalists inside the lab. Because now I have to think about the stand material. Is it going to add something? It should be perfectly transparent to my centimeter waves. And only the slot should matter. How do I make the slot?
Where is this in Gauri?
It's in Gauri Bidnor Observatory, 100 kilometers. You've been there, right? Yeah.
Yes.
So now we convince them to give us space and so on. So this is an observatory 100 kilometers from Bangalore, which is actually much more free from stray electromagnetic waves. And it's used by radio astronomers. So now, kappa earlier was this. PABC minus PA minus PB minus PBC minus PCA plus PA. You remember this formula. The probabilities at the detector plane corresponding various slot combinations when the superposition principle is incorrectly applied would be this. So now, of course, you can read that when we submit the paper next week. But then this is just, you can just, again, same thing you can do. You can just sum it up as various amplitudes. You're incorrectly applying it, of course. So on. And then, P... PBC and all those quantities. So we see that if we compute the numerator of kappa defined for slits, then it is just that, which is actually now equal to P background. Because of course, this is the interesting bit, because in the slit part, what was P0? P0 was when all slits were closed, we still measured something, right? So what is the corresponding thing in slots? When all slots are absent, we measure something. But we actually measure the maximum thing when all slots are absent. Because it's just a source and a detector, and it's just a radiation pattern. So P background is actually a much larger contribution in a slot experiment. In fact, the largest contribution, because otherwise you are blocking them and reducing the contribution. And P0 is a very, very, in the slit version, it's almost negligible. So then now we have to take that into account. So we define the new numerator to be P background minus the numerator for kappa slits, because now P background is kind of going to be higher than all the others, because there are absorbers which are going to absorb parts of it, and only P background will be the largest contribution. So which is zero when we apply the superposition principle incorrectly. Again, the same thing. So the numerator has to be something which has to be zero if the superposition principle is incorrectly applied, and non-zero when we apply it correctly. So we define kappa for slots as kappa slot equals P background minus the same thing that you're used to. So but the P background comes in, and then it's normalized by the maximum again of P background, because that is the global maximum. When you put in slots, those are local maxima. So we want something which is the largest quantity to define. Always, that's how we do things, that we normalize by the largest quantity in the experiment. So that is the maximum P background. The experimental parameters, wavelength is 5 centimeter, which is 6 gigahertz. Slot width is 10 centimeter. Inter-slot distance is 13 centimeter, center to center. Slot thickness, average of 8.4 millimeter. It's actually a composite heterostructure with two absorbers and a metal, so that there is total internal reflection, and it's a perfect absorber. And this absorber is meant for 6 gigahertz, and it's something that we have to buy from some company, which actually makes these absorbers for other purposes. And distance between transmitter horn and slot plane, 1.25 meter. Distance between receiver horn and slot plane is 1.25 meter. So now I will attempt to show you this video, which was working. So this is how the experiment is done. And I think it's something that, if it works, will be nice. It's too big as a file. OK, so it seems like it's starting. So this is how it looks. So you have, you know, an antenna, which is your source now of electromagnetic waves. This is a horn antenna, we call it, and it's chosen for a purpose. We started off with the dipole antenna, went on to another type, and then finally the horn. That's why, again, 2.5 years, the magic number for doing these experiments. And then these are the three slots. So this is a 6 gigahertz. It's got a flare that actually helps in uniform directionality of this experiment. And so these are the three slots. Then you have, he's trying to zoom in. My student worked hard on making this video. And then you have the detector somehow, which will come in. Yeah, so that's the detector. The detector is another horn. And it is sitting on a PVC pipe. And that's important because it's, again, you can't use any material because it will reflect back into the antenna. So you have to use something which is, again, transparent to these microwaves. So that is how it looks, the internal side of the horn. And then how does it... So this is our detector rail that we have manufactured using roller skate wheels, actually. So we again went through several versions of wheels because things can't stop when we don't want it to stop. And so this is also not terribly straightforward. Then we have used an actuator. So it's all done from far because we don't want to obstruct the waves ourselves. That's another thing. So that is how the detector is moving. Huh? Sorry?
That's not a stand in front of my microwaves.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't know what harm my students have gone through. I really don't know. We'll find out. And so then these are the slots. And so then, of course, I think Rengaraj will come in at some point, and we will see. Basically, the idea is that you have this three, and so okay. So that we do the 3, 2, 1, and so people actually go and change the combinations. That's also very important. So this is our results graph, which will come again in the next slide. So you have the experiment, which is the blue, and the red, which is the path integral. Simulation. So we just chose to show the path integral. Now what is interesting, as I was just, okay, start once more. We don't want to see that again. Just one second. Okay, current slide. Right, so now we have done, so of course the red curve is our experimental curve. And the blue line is from theory. And the blue band is a theoretical error band. Now, this is a very important concept in this experiment. So now, blue is the theory. And this has been done using what is called Whipple D. It's wires and plates and dielectrics. It's a software which is specifically used as an electromagnetic solver for radio waves. So this we got from our radio astronomy colleagues. And it's good because it's based on something called method of moments, whereas finite difference time domain is also an electromagnetic solver, which we've talked about earlier. But the problem with finite difference, it takes a very long time because it involves discretization of your integral space. So unless you are lambda by 100, in terms of your smallest grid size, you don't really get convergence. Whereas here, it does not involve that. So somehow, it's a faster simulation, but also equally accurate. And so we have used both, of course, to compare with. And so now, the point is that this is the Vipul-D graph, and this is the theory band. What is theory band? Theory is ideal, right? But it's not. So if you want to do the simulation for your experiment theoretically, then you have to take into account the fact that nothing is ideal. So the point that, you know, we have measured a refractive index for our material. We have actually gone and measured it somewhere. But that comes with a plus minus 10% error. Now, refractive index is a very important quantity. It's a material simulation. So then that gives rise to a confidence level even for the theory. And then there are 23 other parameters which we have simulated and seen whether it's important or not, and only 6 parameters survive in this. I won't bore you with the details because, you know, it's just details, but there are the horn parameters, there's a slot parameter, there's a slot tilt. The slot is sitting it's almost like a photo frame, but then it's not necessarily always going to sit straight like that. Maybe it moves a little. That causes a change. So then we have actually characterized all these parameters and come up with this band. And of course, this graph came, as I was talking to some of you, it came today morning at 7 a.m. So this was 5 days. So we wanted to show you the, you know, definitive, because we have several, of course, such results. And things have started converging for the last 4 or 5 months. Before that, it was all over the place. I mean, you know, and you can see why, because it's literally in an open field. So we have had to do a lot of things to get this within control. And so, of course, you know, we have calculated, and so this error bar calculation, unfortunately, we couldn't finish for this graph before 11 a.m. But the point is that we have done it for several other simulations, the experimental data we have. And, you know, it is definitely, you know, some errors are a little larger, some are smaller. Okay, again, it depends, you know. So you're sitting at a certain position, you have these 7 combinations. Some of them are at a slope, and slope always has more error than a peak or a dip. So then there is a correlation between that also. So, but then again, I won't bore you with the details. But then none of them are big enough that they will make something non-zero, zero. And the best we have got is around a 5 sigma non-zero. That is the confidence level at the center. Center is good because it's kind of close. Yeah.
What are the theory error bars? Are they 1 sigma?
No, it's plus. So basically, this band was created putting in several confidence levels into the simulation software. And the two largest contributions are plus minus 10% for the refractive index. And then there is the other one, which is the height of the wire in the dipole, which forms the horn antenna. That one you can't measure yourself because then you can kill the antenna. You can't go into the antenna and measure it. So you have to calculate it from what is called the S11 measurement. So it's a reflection measurement. Yeah. So then took the closest match to 6 giga, you know, minus 6 dB, which is the ideal thing. We got minus 5.8. Use that parameter and that also gives rise. So then several such gives rise to this band. So this is our latest theory band. But then
you have errors on your fundamental parameters, and then based on those you compute.
We give a confidence level because we are saying that this blue line is not, you know, it's not necessarily, you know, it's a representative line which comes from no such errors. But then we know that these parameters that go into the simulation are not necessarily all zero error themselves. Okay. So that is important for these experiments because otherwise, how will you justify anything? I mean, you know. So that is the Vipul-D. But then, of course, we also have the match with path integral. Somebody is saying something. Sorry. Adrian.
I think you were asking. I was looking. Is there a sort of sigma attached to those theoretical confidence?
Not yet. I don't want to comment on that. Okay. So I mean, I'll tell you day after tomorrow. No, seriously, because I mean, if you say something and then I don't want to take it back.
Absolutely hot off the press.
Yeah, this is 7 a.m. So I mean, you know, nobody slept. Yeah. So, but then because we really wanted to tell you, we don't want to change this because this is a non-zero and it might have some importance to this community that something is non-zero which is otherwise zero. This is path integral, which of course was the ideal this thing. So this is again the same theory, and this experiment graph always comes with dots, as you know. Those are the experimental points. And how did we get this? I mean, this is also not trivial. So you sit at a certain position, you do 3,000 measurements, get 1 kappa, and then you do 10 such kappas, and only then you're satisfied that you have the representative value and go over to the next position. So it takes around 5 days to get this graph. That's why it was timed to, you know, somehow, unfortunately, 7 a.m. today. And then it was raining and so on. Anyway, never mind. And the red curve is the path integral. Now, the path integral one is interesting because, of course, you can't deny. I mean, nothing can match perfectly because otherwise it's fabricated. That's my belief, that, you know, things have to be as they are. And this is the path integral graph. And I do believe that the modulation match is very good. Because, you know, and especially because this is minus 10 to 10 theta. And as I mentioned, when theta, so this is in theta units. So theta is basically, you know, it's the distance divided by the, so essentially you have the slip plane and you have the detector. So you have this distance and then you have this, so you form a theta. And theta kind of makes it universal. You can compare different wavelength regimes, use the same theta. So for IR kappa, the infrared one that we had done, 8-10 nanometer, theta goes from minus 1 to 1. So that is perfect for path integral type matching. But here, of course, you know, it's not as far field as we would want it to be. Our Fresnel number is around 0.04. And IR kappa, it will be around 0.0008 or 0.009, something. So at least an order lower. So for that, we'll have to again do a kilometer experiment. So, but we have to be within meters for a high signal to noise ratio. Otherwise, we'll not measure anything. So then, of course, we have to have that compromise. And so that is why theta is quite, is much larger for microwave experiment than for the path integral. So we would want to say that the path integral match would be best in small theta, which is, let's say, even minus 10 to 10. And so that is the match. But then the point is that the path integral uses thin slit approximation. So if you involve, if you introduce the thickness, and we've discussed that in our theory work, it kind of leads to the integral and not, it's kind of crushes. So because there's a very small thickness and then other parameters are large and so on and so forth, so that doesn't work. So you have to use the thin slit, and in the analytic paper we have shown that if, you can come up with a multiplicative factor. So I mean, again, I don't want to, we have like 2 minutes, so you can read the paper. So then essentially this thin slit, if there is a thickness associated, then, you know, we have some more, so we have a path this way and a path the other way. So there are two sides now of the slit plane. It's not just that, there'll be one corresponding one even on this side. So then it leads to a multiplicative factor for the thin slit approximation to get that to match with FTDT or anything, even experiments, which is of course new. So that is the path integral. And this is the path integral with finite difference time domain, which of course is very important because this is the most common electromagnetic wave solver. And so this is FTDT, and green is finite difference time domain, and red is path integral.
Does that Fabinet mean you did? You're assuming that there were 3 slits and not 3 slots?
No, there are 4 slits. So then that's the discussion. We could definitely have that now. So then there are 2 ways in which you can do the path integral simulation. One is that you can do minus infinity to first slot, then in between there are 2 more slits, and then the end of that to the plus infinity. But the infinity is a difficult thing to establish. So we went to 100 lambda. As our simulation box, and we saw that the change, so we kind of stopped when we saw that the change in kappa at the central position was 10 to the minus 4, so much smaller, so it was converging. So that is what we did. So we did a 4-slit version as well as the version using Babinet, where we have done, essentially we have calculated the contribution from the just the radiation pattern and then subtracted off the slits to get the slot. So the slit ones are easier to define because, you know, it's basically just a simulation box argument, which makes this somewhat more, it converges better and matches much more with other known simulations than the other way of doing it, which we have also done. And I don't have the graph here, but I can show you after the talk. But then, yeah, that was the problem, that this infinity is a difficult thing to kind of define in the simulation box, and which is what we anyway wanted to avoid with the slot experiment, as I said. So then we don't want to bring it in with just because of path integral. And I actually looked it up. I was talking to you yesterday about this, but I looked it up now. I'm quite confident that Babinet does not use this assumption of the naive application of superposition. So we could discuss this offline, of course, yeah. So then that is that. Now, detector nonlinearity is a very important thing because, of course, as Thomas pointed out, that was the reason why his kappa turned out to be zero. So then, of course, we have to do a very good job, and I hopefully have 2 more minutes. Is that fine? Okay. So then we, of course, did what you would expect. So we have the signal generator and we have a power. So the idea of detector nonlinearity was very well discussed yesterday, that essentially what you think the detector should measure, it doesn't quite measure that as the power becomes higher. So it starts becoming nonlinear in its behavior. So we use the data in which two, so we have a power probe is our detector. So that's a certain power meter in the microwave domain. And so I can, don't want to discuss how it works, but then it's a power meter type instrument. And we use two of them connected to the signal generator using a beam splitter or power splitter. And we assume one power probe to be the reference and the nonlinearity of the other power probe with respect to the first power probe is studied. So this is better than treating the signal generator as a reference. As the manual of the signal generator says that there can be a 1 dBm mismatch between what power the signal generator says it emits and what it emits. So we don't want to have a nonlinearity coming in because of the signal generator itself. So we want to remove that and do it as a one-to-one between two power probes, which we trust. So we don't have to have extra scale factors and so on. So signal generator power was varied from 50 dB. This is dBm minus, sorry, the minus is here, minus 50 dBm to 50. This is in log scale and so on. It's milliwatts, actually. And so higher power than this showed obvious nonlinearity, but our experiment does not involve higher power than 15 dBm. So we did it in the range of our experiment. So then we fit the data for power measured in power probe 1 versus that of 2 with the function. So we put in a nonlinear term, so a plus bx plus cx square. So that's, of course, the first level. And so then we obtain A, B, and C, and so on. So in path integral, we compute what we call classical kappa. So what is classical kappa? Classical kappa is the conventional one, which is only due to these single crossing terms. So that is supposed to be zero, as we know. So only when you take in the non, so this is the advantage of path integral, that you can separate out the class of paths. So you have the classical ones, which is the conventional ones, which gives you the zero, and then you add the non-classical and it gives you the new intuition. So then we can, of course, just work with the classical terms, as we call them. And then the power and path integral are rescaled by this background factor, because, of course, we have to somehow generate a graph, which is from a theory, but taking into account the experimental parameters. So PA, for instance, becomes PA times this, where this is a normalization sort of thing. So we compute resultant power due to nonlinearity as, so PA then becomes A plus B times PA plus C times PA square. And similarly, all the other terms change, PB, PC, PAB, PBC, and so on. So then from the resultant power, we calculate kappa. So this is the kappa graph from detector nonlinearity. It's of the order of 10 to the minus 7. So of course, our kappa is 10 to the minus 2. So this is not something which is bothering our experiment up to even 5 orders. But then, you know, it's still modulating because we have, of course, fitted a proper function and calculated it, because we could also do interpolation, but that is not correct. And in fact, we had a lot of discussion on this nonlinearity thing yesterday during the interferometer talk. But then this, of course, because we have the path integral tool, so to speak, it becomes a very simple thing to calculate our expected kappa from nonlinearity. And this is 5 orders lower than our kappa. So it's not a problem for us at all, which is great, because that would kill the project. So conclusions, so in the current microwave version of the experiment, the predictions from theory and experiment show remarkable agreement. We have matched experimental results with in-depth simulations taking into account material parameters. We have also matched experimental results with path integral simulations. Then this is the current thing we can declare. We won't talk about the others till day after tomorrow. All possible sources of error have been estimated and ruled out. For the major one is the non-linearity, because that, of course, can give you a non-zero kappa, as we've discussed. Kappa is non-zero within regular classical electromagnetic theory on correct application of boundary value conditions. And so the third order interference can thus be non-zero without violating quantum mechanics. So that's our conclusion. This is RRI. And so, of course, this is the letter. I think this, I don't know whether you have seen this. So this is the letter we got from the son of Max Born in 2010 when we had done the Born experiment, which was motivated towards Born rule verification. And I don't know, I hope to get some such letter every 7 years. So this is like an emotional motivation when things take 2.5 years on an average to do. So this is what it is. And of course, what I would like to now ask the audience here is that we have a method which matches almost perfectly with an expectation of non-zero from nothing which is unconventional. It's just a boundary value problem. However, the assumption, the thought is that I3 being non-zero is mostly motivated by violation of quantum mechanics kind of arguments. So now what is the I3 that I should be looking for in my experiment? Because I'm, of course, explaining my non-zero extremely well with very simple physics. You know, it's ultimately it's simple. It takes time, but it's simple. So now what is your expected I3? What is the formula for a violation of quantum mechanics, and what is the I3? Because Thomas mentioned that I got 10 to the minus 7, so I need not worry about non-classical parts. But now the point is, how do you know what is the contribution to I3 from a Born rule violation which is motivated by some actual theory? It could be 10 to the minus 7. Then you will miss it in your experiment as well. So now I have a thing which matches. So what should I do to look for this? So when will I be convinced that, so is it like, okay, I have this match, but suppose it was much larger, then I will also have to fill it in with a Born rule violation argument? Or is it independent? So I now that we have this, this is a question that I would like to now pose, of course, to you. And of course, yeah, let's not. So that's it. Yeah, thanks.
So my intuition about this is hazy, but let me try something out. If you go back to the slits rather than the slots,
sure.
if you constructed little walls coming out perpendicular from the slits,
yeah,
would you kill off these extra
that. Yeah. So wait, did I plant this question, Adrian? So this is your idea.
In the middle between the slits.
So this is what it is, right? So this is your two slits. So I have put something which is kind of intersecting it right in the middle. So yeah. This is the slot.
Okay, so I'm intrigued by this. Tell us about this.
Yeah. So this is a simulation we have also done to answer this question. But of course, I didn't expect that to be the first question. So, okay. So then, of course, what is the thing? So then you have, we call these baffles. Mm-hmm. And this was actually Tony Leggett who coined this. Why don't you put baffles in your simulation to see what happens? So we call them baffles now. So we did the simulation. So the idea is that you have a source, you have a detector, and then you have this, we call this, so the red line denotes the, so the red line denotes the forbidden path. So in the sense that if you put that baffle, then that red line will not occur. And if you remove the baffle, then it will. So that's what we are saying here. So when the baffle is in front of the slits, the grazing paths are allowed. So now it's here, then it's allowed. But then when it's in the middle, then it should kill off that contribution. So then that's exactly the idea. So can you somehow put something perpendicular to your slit plane so that, because we say that the hugging path is the major contribution, then it should just be killed off. That's your intuition. I mean, you're hazy about it, but I'm not. Okay.
So maybe it consists of anything, I'm not sure. My baffles...
Why don't you draw them? Okay. Your baffles. It's baffling, though. Yeah.
I guess they were going to go sort of up like this.
No, but then that's just the slot word. I mean, I'm just doing the slit thing, right? So these are like openings.
Yeah.
So I've blocked the path, that's all. So it's the same thing.
Well, is it?
Yeah, so these are opaque, yeah. And I'm just blocked. So this is the path.
Yeah, yeah.
Forget about baffle. So the red is the path that we have calculated, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Now, if I block it, it shouldn't be there.
Correct.
It's as simple as that.
And you could block it with something here.
Sure, but that is the same thing.
Does it do exactly the same? Because you seem to be sort of suppressing stuff that's going through the slits this way, whereas this allows all
no, the actually, that's the purpose of this drawing. That this actually will go, but get blocked here. I mean, I'm not going to say thickness of paths and all. It's path integral. But then this baffle is enough that it actually leaves some hole to allow paths to go through, but then it won't allow this path to. So I'll show you, let me just show you what happens. So then baffle simulation.
Your slits block the paths on the other part of the slide?
Sorry, what? Adrian's baffle?
The second slot, that would block both of those paths, right? You can put your baffles in the middle.
Yeah.
So they're different to the ones that are there.
So, but the idea is the same, that, you know, somehow can you kill the contribution? So that,
yeah, the idea is the same.
Yeah.
But maybe,
so this is what we have simulated.
Different effects, I'm not sure.
We could, I mean, we could do different types of simulation, but this is what we chose to do.
Yeah.
And so, of course, so the point is that if there is no baffle, you know, then this is the red curve. This is the usual one we get. So this is from some parameters. So let's not worry about exactly. I mean, this is the same as a microwave parameter, actually. But then, so this is a red baffle. No baffle. So that's the curve. And then when you put a baffle, which is, so as we keep increasing the baffle size, expectation is that the kappa will drop. And so that's the, that's what it tells you. So if this is done, this is log scale. And so, so maximum kappa, we've plotted it as a function of baffle size, and it's kind of, there's a symmetrically placed one, as I told you. And so it's, of course, it started off being 0.06. That was our original. So this is mod. So we have removed negative, you know, just so that it makes sense. So it was minus 0.06, the central kappa. So it's that is the one. And then it kind of drops. So it even goes down to 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5, so forth. So yeah, indeed. So this is like a proof that our, so this is an additional one. So this, over and above, of course, matching with finite difference time domain and everything else, this is just exactly to for your kind of question. So, but yeah, and thank you, because it looked like a planted question. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, sorry, you are the moderator, because we have three hands.
So you, when you initially talked about the theories, you imagine that the material out of which the slits is in is perfectly absorbing. Hmm. But if that wasn't the case, if it reflected to some extent,
we've done that also.
Okay, then presumably it's the case then that when you have, say, one slit open, there are paths that contribute, which now go away when you have both slits open, because a path could
reflect take, off
could reflect off where the material where the slit would be.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering how that affects.
That would be weird though, because I mean that's why you don't want to do this experiment using metal.
Right.
I mean, you know, why did we choose an absorber? Just to avoid.
Presumably, there's no perfect absorber. So
it is indeed a perfect absorber.
Sorry again?
It is indeed a perfect absorber. So
in the experiment.
In the experiment, yeah. So, I mean, not in path integral. I mean, when I said that it's not perfect, I meant that in the path integral simulation, you can't take into account the imperfectness and so on. That's because it goes in a little. But then the point is, so how is the absorber manufactured? So we have an absorber sheet, then we have a metal sheet, then we have another absorber sheet. So the idea is that something is going this way, hitting the absorber, it's, let's say, getting absorbed, but maybe not fully, because nothing is perfect, is the impression. But then it hits the metal, and so basically it just remains within that heterostructure. So there's going to be some total internal reflection kind of thing. It's going to keep bouncing back and forth, remaining in that heterostructure. But the problem is that this is now a three-layered structure. So if you look at it from the side, you have the absorber, you have a little bit of the metal, and then you have the absorber. So then that actually leads to a little bit of error from the side. Because there is that metal which is which we see, not we, I mean the waves. They see that. So that actually is captured by our simulations. But in front, of course, there is no such. It doesn't come back to the antenna. That's very important.
But it's really interesting. I mean, even if you have imperfect absorbers, then just theoretically, it's interesting that there's another way in which the superposition, naive superposition principle can break down. Because paths that
No, but then they would still not cross the slits more than once. So it would be reflected off. So this is like an error.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be a superposition principle argument is not the one that I would use. Because, of course, you know, it wouldn't even reach the second slit. I mean, as Rafael pointed out, that the whole point of this crossing or intersection, whatever it is, that when you have the slit open, there is this contribution which comes in and so on. But in this case, it's just some sort of scattering error a little bit, which will come in because of the metal. But then, of course, these are subdominant, so still, I mean, so it's not going to be the same thing that you're verifying. If you use, you'll just do an experiment which is non-ideal, even more so, because then you might have something coming back to your source. That's the big problem. That you have a metal and there is a horn antenna sitting there. Whole point is that everything goes only forward. But then if there is a metal, then it will reflect something back. and that changes your source. And that's a big problem for an experiment, that if your source is changing with time, then of course that's a very big error, and it will give you non-zeroness in various levels. So that is something we have to avoid. And so that, which we have done further experiments using things called circulators. So if you put a circulator, then what happens is anything that comes back gets grounded. So nothing goes back to the antenna. So our experiment involves that, and so on. Yeah.
Now, there are some paths are similar. I mean, just as a follow-up, and I'm not sure if it's what Lucien was referring to. You could have a path that went through one slit, came back through the other slits, and then just kept.
That's what I meant.
Is that what you meant?
Yeah, but it could still be reflected.
So, came back is what you meant, Lucien?
I mean, both it's open, the path could.
But it has to go back to the detector, otherwise it's not even.
Where I've got back to that half of the field.
Yeah, so then it has to cross it again.
No, but if the slit were closed, then it could get reflected off and go to the detector.
Sorry.
So there are two slits now. Both slits are open.
Yeah.
The path comes in, goes through one slit, and then goes back. For the other slit, it disappears. It's never detected.
Yeah.
But if the lower slit is closed.
Yeah. So that's what I'm saying. So that would be a scattering kind of effect. You're saying.
It can be reflected to the detector. Yeah.
If your slit is closed with a metal metal, then it would. There's a probability that something will get reflected off. Yeah. But then that is. Not going to be any comment on the. It's an error which we have to then calibrate for, and we don't. We don't want to do that in the experiment, but theoretically it will be interesting. But we have. I can show you offline. We have done the metal slot kappa simulations as well, just to see what happens, because it's easier to do metal than a hetero structure, at least to manufacture. But then it's not good because the source changes. And that, then it's not a good experiment anymore. Because what do I mean by the source changes? So that is that. There is the metal here. Something comes, it comes back. Because again, the same idea, that it will reflect back. And then if it comes back, then the source pattern will change. This is how it looks usually, but there will be a change. And so then if the source changes for different combinations of the experiment, then you'll get a non-zero. Which is, of course, just an error. Because the whole in this experiment, all combinations have to see the same source. Otherwise, that's the biggest error that we could have, which we don't. So, yeah.
What was the S11 of this?
Minus 5.7 dB. The heterostructure itself. Oh, the sheet is much better. Is much better. It's around minus 20.
So minus 20 dB. So 1% is reflected. 1% of
minus 20, not even minus 20. I don't want to be quoted on this. It's comparable to the noise floor of your measuring device. So it's around, it's 36, minus 36 is the number I remember. But I will see it and tell you. I mean, it's a measurement we have done, but I don't remember the number. But it was noise flow.
I was wondering if you could measure, I guess you have measured this, the whole contributions, open, close, and everything. So what is the bare signal if you look at, for instance, the case where two slots are there or not? If you subtract the two signals, you should see an interference pattern between two slits.
Can you repeat that, please?
I'm curious to see a usual interference pattern, what you call IN. And that looks. That's also.
Yeah, you can't make out the difference between. Of course, that has all the contributions. What you measure always has all the contributions. So if you wanted to actually just bank on that and not worry about kappa, then they overlap. The with and without, they overlap. So then that's not good. But then, of course, we have done 8 combinations, 3,000 times. And so on. So all of them are there. I'll show you the graph.
Looking just at kappa, will you?
Yeah, kappa is good because it kind of captures the effect. Otherwise, it's going to be overlapping curves. And
I too would be nice also.
Oh, yeah. Everything is, of course, a part of kappa. Yes, all of them are there.
And do you plan on varying, for instance, the distance between states to see the dependency on the.
Well, we've come as close as we can get, you know.
But if you go further apart, you should see a dependence which is in square root or,
Yeah, but that would be making kappa smaller. And it's taken 2 years to get it above error. So I wouldn't want to.
You have 2 years of averaging?
2 years of averaging. No, no, no. 2 years to do the experiment. No, not 2 years.
Okay.
that's something. Yeah.
So I guess increasing D is not.
No, increasing D is fine, but then it'll decrease kappa, right?
Yes.
And so then the error is of a certain order, 10 to the minus 3. Kappa is 10 to the minus 2. But if I decrease kappa to 10 to the minus 3, then I have spent considerable time to try and make it even less, which is not possible. This experiment is as error-free as we can get in the conditions. So we don't want to decrease kappa.
Are you just wondering if you would see the expected dependence of I2 on that?
Yeah,
two?
Exactly.
But not an experiment that one can do convincingly. Because if you want to really show this in this regime, you better have the quantity as high as you can make it. So if you
not
make
sure,
it further...
I'm just saying it would be much more convincing than comparing to theory. If you have an experimental dependence of kappa...
Why is theory bad?
Well, theory. So you have 30 parameters.
There are three different ways in which we have done the theoretical simulation which overlap.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I would become a theorist at this point. I would trust theory.
I
pointed out why it is not... just to complete that. It's because if I make that larger, then kappa drops, and then it becomes comparable to my error threshold. And so then it's a very bad experiment.
Sure.
So even if it is possible theoretically to conceive of it, practically I wouldn't want to do it because then I'm comparable to the error threshold. And that's what we want to avoid, of course. I mean, the versions which we've already heard of are within that error threshold. And so that is the problem. Otherwise, yeah, I agree, but yeah. Sorry, I mean, I think he kept doing that.
So your experiment's mounted on lumber, like timber stands, is that? Or?
It's a high-density thermocol.
Okay. And it's a border like a meter high?
1.5. Yeah, I mean, the people can actually reach it and put the slot,
okay.
So it's kind of human height, yeah.
So do you have an estimate of how mechanically compliant these things are? How much do they move? Like what is that, millimeters, like 10 to the minus 4 meters?
It's 0.3 millimeters is the number. So basically, that's a very good point, actually. So now, so this slot stand is not made of marble. So it is, of course, prone to moving as well.
Yeah.
So in fact, for some time, we had a wrong estimation of the center, horn center to the slot stand, the relative position in the simulation.
Mm-hmm.
So in fact, we realized that because we are using a tri-square to do this alignment, carpentry tool. I mean, precisely, we have a spirit level and a tri-square.
Wow.
I didn't want to go into that, but then, so indeed, so but then of course, that has a 1 millimeter error. So then, of course, that translates to an error in theta. So then we had to correct for that by slight movement of the stand. And then, I mean, you haven't seen maybe the video, I don't want to play it in because it's too big, but then we have actually put bricks to, and then we have things called Kadapa stone, which is a poor man's marble, which is used to level the surface. Because you know what happens with stones? They actually sag. So if there is rain, things sag. So you have to keep leveling it every few months.
I mean, do you have problem with wind and phonons coming? Like, are these changing the distances?
Wind we had problems with in the beginning, but now we have this tint.
Okay,
which,
and phonon modes coupling up through the structure? Right? Okay.
It's not... I don't think it'll be.
So millimeters.
Okay, so that brings me to another experiment which I didn't tell you about. So this is related to ground reflection measurements.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially, the ground also reflects. So this is analogous to your question, but in an experimental situation. So we've done it. So we have actually taken the source and the detector and increased the height and shown that it does affect it up to, let's say, half a meter. But once you would go beyond 1 meter, then it just drops. So that is also a measurement we have done. To avoid anything, because everything radiates at some point. So I mean, we only want the one that we are interested in. So then we have filters at the detector, only at 6 gigahertz. So we have bandpass filters, which only allow 6 and a little bit around it. But of course, 6 gigahertz is great, because mobile phones work at 1 or 2. So, and students don't use it on the field anyway.
Yeah.
So there is no interference for 6, very little.
Did the monkeys take any interest in this experiment?
The cats.
The cats.
So then now that we have the tent, they like to go and sleep.
I see.
So then unfortunately, it's not a Schrodinger cat, it's a classical cat. No, not the monkeys.
No.
You remember the monkeys.
Yeah.
Yeah, somehow they don't go that far into the field. They are near the canteen area,
which
is favorable
for
them. Yeah.
let me actually suggest to move to lunch.
Sure, yeah, sorry.
So thank you again.
Thank you.